You are listening to Friends of Europe's podcast. Don't miss our debates on global and European issues that span political, economic, social, and environmental challenges. And follow our website at friendsofeurope.org.
Good afternoon, everybody, ladies and gentlemen, excellencies, welcome to our discussion today on a new development policy for Europe. And the question we're going to explore is whether the EU, what the EU needs to do better and what it needs to do more in this rapidly changing world, as we've seen with the refugee crisis happening in Europe at the moment. The world is changing very fast, it's very interconnected, very interdependent, and it's changing rapidly in many unpredictable ways, and not always in the direction that we would like it to go. I'm Shada Islam. I'm Director of Policy at Friends of Europe. This panel discussion is part of our Development Policy Forum, which many of you know was set up by Friends of Europe with leading European and international partners some years ago. So just a few words about why we're holding this conversation now today. Of course, you all know that in about 10 days in New York, world leaders will be gathering for the United Nations Sustainable Development Agenda. They'll be adopting, is it 17 SDGs with 169 targets? And of course, we'll all be watching this General Assembly very, very carefully. For most of this year as well, development issues have been very high on the European Union agenda. And of course, if these SDGs are going to be implemented over the next 15 years, the European Union will have a pivotal, a very important role to play in financing, but also in this development, global development partnership. EU development policy, and I'm sure Klaus will talk to us about it, has been adjusting, adapting to the new world order. But as I said earlier, the refugee crisis has shown to us that a lot more needs to be done. Earlier this year, we asked some of our development experts, part of our network of development experts, to give us some of their ideas, their insights into how they would like a new European development policy adapted to the needs of the 21st century. How would they like that to look? And the response was really very enthusiastic. We got submissions from many of our friends and colleagues, and we've published it, and we're launching it today, this publication where you will get some very interesting ideas about where the EU should be in this new global agenda. Many of our submissions were also put on our website in the weeks leading up to this discussion. So let me introduce our panelists very, very quickly. You have their CVs, so I'm not going to go into any details of their various talents and skills, just very briefly. Klaus Rudi Schausser is, of course, well-known here in Brussels. He's Deputy Director General for International Cooperation and Development at the European Commission, DG DEFCO. Heike Rutgers is from the European Investment Bank and has worked for many years in Africa, so your experience on development policy is very valuable here. Yves Guiquero is from the Agence Française de Développement. Also, Yves, you have lived and worked in Africa and in many other emerging countries for many, many years. James McKee is Senior Advisor at the European Centre for Development Policy Management, ECDPM, also very well known here. And last but not least, definitely not least, is Natalia Alonso, Head of the EU Office of Oxfam. Thank you very much, Natalia, for coming here as well. Many of our panellists are actually contributors to this publication, so you can read their articles here as well as listen to them now. So the rules of the game, and you know it, are very, very simple. I will ask a question, and I will ask you, request you to answer in about 5 minutes or so, a follow-up or not, depending on what you've said. And then, of course, I'll open the floor to all our participants here. And I care, again, you know, so many of you here have such knowledge of the issues we're discussing, and I'd like your comments briefly, please. I've told all of you panelists that I really want to kick off with the refugee crisis and its implications, its impact on European development policy. Now, it's being said that the refugee crisis is the first test for the SDGs, even before they're in place, even before they're implemented. And many have said, and I think we all agree, that really the situation we face today is the result of a failure or a weakness of our development policy, especially when it comes to fragile states, and especially when it comes to dealing with structural deficits and structural imbalances in many of these countries. So very quickly, Klaus, I'd like to turn to you first and get some of your ideas about how you think development policy in Europe could change to adapt to this crisis, which is not going to go away, which is going to stay with us for many years to come.
to everybody. Obviously, what we see now is really dramatic, and we are slightly overwhelmed by it. And in particular, we see a very dramatic problem with European solidarity, not so much amongst populations. I really don't want to blame European citizens, but I think we can be a little bit critical about a number of European politicians. And I do hope that that this over time will get better when people will have time to think a little bit more about it. But it's clearly yet a stronger test for European solidarity, and the Greek crisis is. So that's one thing. The other thing where I would a little bit disagree with you is that this is not a failure of development policy, because what we see now is the direct fallout of crisis and of conflicts. And obviously, development policy is not the policy that addresses conflicts as such. But it's clear that it's linked, and you can hear that every day now at television. Suddenly, people discover development policy, which they didn't think about too much in recent years. And everybody thinks now that the solution is in development policy, which again is only very partially true, because we need addressing the conflicts, we need addressing the crisis, and that means the whole range of instruments, from political instruments to even military instruments, and the willingness there also for currently is a little bit limited after some bad experiences over the last years, in particular in Iran and Afghanistan, Iraq and Afghanistan, sorry. Now, to be very precise and to be very clear, what is our response is we have proposed in the package from last week to create a European trust fund to address root causes and to address what we can do from a development point of view on better managing migration. For this trust fund, we are mobilizing 1.8 billion euros. Some of it is reprogrammed, some of it is fresh money. The largest part of it is fresh money. We are proposing this to member states. This is only a proposal at this stage. It still has to be approved by member states. And obviously, it will only work as the way it is supposed to work if member states put in money into this trust fund. Because otherwise, we would just be doing more of the same. We have done development policy for the last 60 years. And it was always oriented towards promoting the situation in developing countries and thereby reducing the pressure to leave countries. We very well know that as countries develop, migration, especially economic migration, picks up. But what we talk here about is mainly refugees from situations which are not livable. So as I said, we have to avoid that we just do a little bit more of what we did the last 40, 50, 60 years. And therefore, we need a trust fund and work together with member states, pool resources, pool activities, and really also get a joint European response. So our hope is that member states will approve this trust fund and that they will come in and contribute to it so that we can actually do better than we did in the past, not just more, but better.
So I guess one thing that, Klaus, will be important is that you said the public is discovering development policy, and I guess one of the challenges will be to keep that public interest in development policy as we go towards the next few decades. Heike, I would like to get your opinion also on how this will impact some of the work that you are doing.
Absolutely. As the European Investment Bank is the EU bank, our president actually addressed the ministers of finance last Friday by saying, I mean, the EIB stands ready also to contribute to that exercise following the launch of this proposal for an emergency trust fund. And as we are operating actually on both sides within Europe as well as in the countries affected, so from where people are coming from, we consider that we can operate on both angles. I think it I would fully subscribe to what Klaus said earlier. What we discover now is actually that the step now to go for a more universal approach is the right thing to do, because we had defined our development policy goals we took a very narrow view. And now we see, as development arrives at our homes, if I may say so, in Europe, we see that we need to have a more holistic approach to it and have also different answers, different ways of doing. I mean, our president said we should do development investment in a different way. The scope of what needs to be done is much broader. I think everybody realized that. And we really hope with a more comprehensive goal setup we have with the SDGs, this will give us the skeleton to really work out the right ways of doing things.
So, Eve, so the question is development investment in a different way, which is Heike talked about. So do you think that this is something that one can put up, put together very quickly in the face of the crisis of the kind we're facing now?
I think that the European Union is very rich of several instruments, several institutions, and Europe can rely on a global alliance between the European Commission and the member states' institution, because you have different kinds of tools. You have grants, you have loans, you have guarantees, you have knowledge, you have experience. And just the announcement made by the President Juncker a few days ago regarding the setup of this trust fund is very interesting and very important, because we are talking about 1.8 billion euros, so this is huge. This announcement has been built on the positive experience of a previous trust fund we have set up together, which was the Bekou Fund in Central African Republic. And this was a common European response to this crisis. And when you are talking about how to address this refugee crisis and the roots of the crisis, you need to adapt your own instruments to operate and to be more efficient, to be more flexible, to engage faster. To address the roots of the problem. So I think that this announcement is very, very positive and is very representative of what a common European response can be done to this problem.
Done or not done?
Done or not done.
Yeah, thank you. James, I want to come back to the question I asked Klaus about how this is an indication of not the word failure that I use, but weakness of European development policy or international development policy more generally. Inability to tackle structural deficits and root causes that cause people to leave. The push factors, if you like.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, everybody. Yes, I think you've got a point, but I would perhaps dwell on two points. First of all is that the crisis shows to us is the importance of coherence between different types of policy. I mean, this integrated approach is required. And in the development sector, we have been talking for 15 years now about the importance of policy coherence. We have tended to talk about policy coherence of development for development, i.e. internal policies of the EU should not undermine development policy. But in fact, what we're seeing now is the reverse, that we're finding the lack of policies of our international policies are undermining our internal policies, the asylum policy, etc. It's actually coming back to bite us, in a sense. And that, I would hope that we can build on that to stress to people that, you know, this is policy coherence is really actually the most important thing. So I wouldn't actually say that it's development aid that is really at fault here.
It is development policy.
Fair enough. Okay, but I mean, I would emphasize that point. I mean, it's not just about the aid business. It's about so many other things. And here you said at the start, Shada, that this is a test for the SDGs. It's actually a test for many of the SDGs. I mean, some of the social ones and the education, health, and things like that. But the one I would really focus on would be SDG 16 on conflict, peace, justice, and inclusive institutions. That is really where, if there had been more effort in that area, there has been effort in that area, but more comprehensive effort in that area, I think that's really where the real solution to this crisis is. And we should learn the lesson for that looking forward. I mean, the crisis can happen again elsewhere.
So would you then think, Natalia, that the UNGA, the General Assembly this year, should really set aside all the rest of the, given the magnitude of the crisis and the challenge we face, that we should really focus on this crisis and its links to development in SDGs, rather than going through the whole series of speeches and rituals and formalities that often mark United Nations GA.
Well, good afternoon to everyone. I would like to make just a previous point to respond to your question, Shada, about migration. Migration is not a threat that needs to be stopped. Migration is something that has been happening all the way through and it continue to happen, and it needs to be managed, definitely. So that's the first point I want to make. Obviously, we need to make an analysis of why people are migrating. What are the causes of people migrating? Obviously, when they are fleeing conflict, wars, inequality, unemployment, poverty, that's forced migration. But also people migrate for their reasons. And I think most of, at least half of this room would be people who have migrated from different places in Europe. I am from Spain, so obviously I migrated to Brussels for different reasons. So the point I want to make here is that we may need to make a distinction between what is forced migration and, you know, migration in terms of looking for opportunities and that can be easily managed. Now, forced migrations, if you look at the root causes of that migration, as I mentioned, is inequality, is conflict. And some of these issues were not really dealt by the Sustainable Development Goals, by the MDGs, and is now an opportunity with the SDGs to look at that. And I think that's a big change from the previous framework. The question is how these SDGs are going to change the way we work and the way we influence things. In particular, how the EU could react to this question of migration crisis right now, obviously, I think it needs a collective response. I think it's not a no-brainer. But it's also to make aware that although the numbers are impressive, Europe is rich. It's not only rich, it's the richest continent, and we can afford maximum 1% of our population to include them into our societies. So the SDGs can afford that and the implementation of that, looking at the root causes. Now, another point that Jamie pointed out about policy coherence for development, I won't name specifically EU member states, but the reality is that if you look at what's happening in Yemen now, that 85% of people are depending on food aid, and a lot of member states and the European Union is helping them. But at the same time, European governments are selling arms to governments who are bombing Yemen. So this is the policy coherence for development that we need to tackle.
Thank you very much. You very tactfully avoided my question about the UNGA, but that's okay. That's okay. It was more rhetorical and what I would like to happen at the UN, frankly. Okay, Klaus, let's come back to the question which is really on our agenda, the SDGs per se, and what happens next. Now, it's a vast agenda, universal, holistic, comprehensive. What will be the impact on your actions? Will you be choosing, selecting, identifying certain areas for more focused attention in the coming years?
That's a good question. and I will follow up with a number of questions, because obviously we have to ask ourselves a number of questions. Indeed, first of all, we have to ask ourselves, how is our response going to be inside the EU and how is it going to be outside the EU? Both are clearly linked, but it's also clear it cannot be the same response because inside the EU we are very far advanced on achieving most of the SDGs, whereas outside of the EU it's a different story. So this is the first question that has institutional links because inside the Union Mr. Timmermans is in the lead and outside Mr. Mimica is in the lead. So we are discussing now how to address this in a coherent way. Next question is, what does it mean indeed? For example, for our financial instruments, for the way we cooperate with third countries. And you know that we have a midterm review coming up in 2017. So the question is, how does this affect the instruments that we work with? Another question is, should we prioritize some of the SDGs or not? Are they all the same? Are they equally important? And when you look at some developing countries, clearly that's not the case. You will remember that in the Agenda for Change, we had announced a couple of clear priorities. So the question is, should we revise those priorities? And then another question is, how is our overall response going to be? Is it going to be one by each of the 28 member states and one by the Commission? Or is it going to be a joint response? And that, for example, would raise the question, do we want to reopen or to update the European consensus? Is that something that could, for example, lead us into a new era of cooperation with member states or of working together in the outside field? So all these are questions, since we don't have all the answers, we're going to launch a public consultation, ask you to tell us what we should do. And as you have seen, the Friends of Europe have already responded before we even launched the public consultation. So this is a very welcome contribution. Now, to be serious, we will, as I said, launch a public consultation. It is quite likely that Mr. Timmermans will come out with a general umbrella policy document sometime next year after the public consultation, obviously. We will do the same for the external field in coherence with what comes out. In all likelihood, we will propose a revision of the European consensus and put on the table a draft for a new European consensus. This is for the moment under discussion, but I don't think I disclose a secret if I say that here. So this is in very general terms the way we map this out. But then, as I said, there are more open questions. Are all SDGs the same? You mentioned SDG 16, which is obviously something which is not so much addressed in our current policy, and certainly not in the European consensus, or in a very, very insufficient way. So there are still quite a few questions. On the other hand, I think it is clear that the EU, in many respects, will take the lead on this and will again, I think, show the way for many others who don't have the same level of commitment and who don't have the same level of internal achievement already. So it's going to be really, a landmark decision. And on some areas, we are already seeing that we are leading. If you take the SDGs, they were relatively easy to agree because on the substance, everybody could easily agree. It was much more difficult to agree on how to achieve them. And that was the background of the Addis conference, which in the end brought, I think, a very good outcome, also because we had a very strong role. We played a very strong role there. And some of the issues that we are putting on the table, like mobilizing more money through development banks, like domestic resource mobilization, are really taking the lead. And they're going to be instrumental for achieving the SDGs. Just an anecdote, we're going to organize a side event on domestic resource mobilization in New York, and I keep getting people who invite themselves who would like to speak at this event because they find it so interesting that everybody invites himself to speak at this event. So everybody wants to be part of this new collect more, spend better approach, which I think is the right approach. And that is going to be key for the implementation of the SDGs. That means we also still have to convince many developing countries that this is the key where they have to change. We can maybe keep many of the things we did in development policy, because certainly not everything is wrong. But we need to get a different kind of working together between aid and the political response from developing countries. That's where a big change has to happen. And I think we are on a good way to at least get more attention on this approach.
Pointed to a very important challenge, Klaus, which is really the EU is strong, but what is the EU? Is it 1 plus 28, or is it actually one big, solid Europe working together? And the other thing you said is a different kind of working together within sectors, but also in the international community and within the EU. And I hope that the SDGs will get better cooperation among all kinds of stakeholders, if you like, than we've had so far, where it's been very much us and them in terms of the MDGs. Heike, I wanted to ask you a very general question as well about how the new SDG agenda will impact on the bank's policies.
Absolutely, and a very, very relevant question. Actually, the bank has engaged very actively in the whole discussion around the SDGs. You may have followed that there had been, for the first time, a joint statement by the group of the MDBs, the multilateral development banks, at the spring meetings of the World Bank. So there has been a joint commitment, actually, from the group of the MDBs to really play a major role in the implementation of the SDGs and so also in the mobilization of other resources, as we cannot tackle the challenges on our own, and so to come up with new financial instruments with what we can call smart development finance to actually mobilize these extra resources. So there is a very strong commitment in that area. And I would say, as the SDGs are universal, they come along our way. It's a lot of these goals, which we already have also as objectives within the Union, which are now looked at on a global basis and where we can bring in our expertise as an EU institution together with the European Commission. And I think we see first steps of working differently. We have already started to use blending in earlier days. We have had the first experience which we collected and on which we can build on in the future. It's also a different way of working more with other partners. For example, at the EIB we have been engaging partnerships now with partners like UNIDO, like FAO, so to work differently and to have a more holistic approach in the way we do things and we look at things.
In this publication, in fact, the head of the African Development Bank speaks very strongly in favor of a stronger partnership with the EIB, as it were. Thank you, Heike. Eve, the question and your article in our publication talks about the need for smart ODA. And I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about how you want this to be a priority in the coming years.
Thank you, Shada. Yes, in this article, I trace the fact that if you are comparing the amount of available ODA and the needs and the ambition of the SDGs, you see that there is a little problem, because ODA total amount is in the range of $130 billion per year, and the SDG financing needs annually are in the range of thousands of billion dollars. So this is impossible to address the SDG ambition only with ODA. But within ODA, it should be reminded that 60% of ODA is provided by the European Union state members. This is huge. And this is why the European had a so strong voice for the negotiation in the financing for development process for preparation of Addis Ababa conference, but also for the SDG issue and the preparation of the New York conference in the next 2 weeks. So European has a strong role, and European has experiment to coalize some actors and to build European architecture for aid and development assistance. And within this European architecture for aid, there is a global consensus to concentrate the bulk of ODA for fragile states. We are talking about the routes of migration, conflicts, states affected by conflicts, but also for the less developed countries and the poorest countries in the world. And the most important part of ODA should be concentrated in this country. But you can also use one small part of ODA in order to help to catalyze other kind of resources, to leverage other kinds of resources, and to support domestic actors to mobilize themselves financial resources needed for SDG implementation. And how can you do that? You have this very interesting and successful experience initiated by the European Commission 6 years ago with the creation of blending facilities. This was to mix grants with loans. With loans provided by European financial institutions as EIB, as AFD, KfW, EBRD and other actors, but also to mobilize other sources of financing. And if you are looking at the result and the figures, you can see that within the last 6 years, European Commission put 2 billion euros on the table. This has leveraged 19 billion euro loans, concessional loans from European financial institutions. But this has also leveraged other sources of financing from non-European financial institutions and from domestic actors, national development banks, private banks, and so on. And at the end of the process, this have conduct to financing 44 billion euro investment in developing countries. So you can create leverage effects, and this shows that you need to use parts of ODA to support local actors on the routes, because they will be at the front of ODA implementation. Who is in the best position to know where are the needs, how to plan, to program investment, how to implement them, how to finance them? There are local authorities, municipalities, domestic banks, private sector, companies, utilities, and so on, and for sure domestic and local governments. And they need help for capacity building, for expertise, and for mobilizing available resources, because the most important available financial resources are within the countries, within developing countries. This is the issue of domestic resource mobilization, addressed by Klaus a few minutes ago. You have the domestic banking sector, you have domestic saving, and you should mobilize them to finance SDGs.
And the domestic private sector as well.
Yes, including, for sure.
So just give me an idea of how much of this implementation will actually hinge on contributions from private sector. Is it going to be a massive player in the new decade?
Oh, for sure. And they are already in the bulk of investment. If you are looking at the figure of investment in developing world, the private sector is already playing a big role. I were mentioning the amount of total ODA. This was 130 billion euro. But if you are looking at the figure for private investment flowing from north to south countries, this is in the range of 400 to 500 billion dollars, yes, annually. So this is four times the amount of ODA.
Thank you, Eve. Jamie, you have heard Klaus talk about how he believes the new SDG agenda will change parts of the EU way of working in development field. In your view, with your experience and your watchful eye on EU development policy for the last several years, where would you see the change coming and how would you like it to come about?
Well, I think Klaus has already alluded to one or two things. I mean, certainly the emphasis on domestic resource mobilization is, I think, absolutely of prime importance. I mean, that's where the big money is. And that's, if you want to run the trio of the social protection, education and health, universal health care, I mean, you cannot do it without local tax money. I mean, you can't do that on aid. You can't you can't do that with private capital. Aid can help, private resources can help, but the real money has to come from domestic resources. So that is really very important. And looking at the ways that aid then becomes a question of, can you help developing countries improve their tax take by improving their tax systems and maybe upgrading their Inland Revenue Authority, etc. There's a lot of work to be done there. But I would come back again to the question of policy coherence. I mean, I may sound like a one-track record, but I think that's the whole record. But the whole spirit of the SDGs is very much this integrated approach. The MDGs, we tried to concentrate on the social sectors, and we got a long way, but we came again and again to the realization that without the economic side, without the environmental side, we were blocked. And so we need this integrated approach. It's far more complex, but in the end, we have to do it. And this is policy coherence is at the heart of that. So I would say if the Commission is looking at the consensus, and I would agree that it does need to be revised in the light of this major change, it should also be putting a much higher, stronger emphasis on some of the policy coherence aspects of it. We've got five, the Council agreed years ago, the five priority areas where we would look at policy coherence: migration, security, food security, climate change. What about consumption in Europe? I mean, that's the sort of issue. Our consumption patterns here in Europe, will Mr. Timmermans be addressing that in his that is vital for development. So I think we need to revisit that and realize much more thoroughly how our policies in different areas across the whole spectrum of EU policy, how that will affect our external policy. Security policy, I mean, there is discussion about a global strategy replacing the European security strategy. I mean, that has to have the SDGs at the core of it. Somehow that has to be linked up, synchronized, coherent with the new consensus, whatever it's to be called.
So actually, in a sense, what happens in New York in a couple of days will actually be the start of a long process of internal rehaul and overhaul and revamp of EU development policy. Natalia, in your article in our publication, you talk about what you would like your grandchildren to remember about 2015 and this hopefully defining moment that we are faced with at the moment. You talk about a light bulb moment, and I was wondering if you could articulate for us a little bit what this light bulb moment you hope for and what it will mean in terms of the way we organize development partnerships.
Well, this is an incentive for you to go and read the article, why the light bulb means. But basically the question is, I put myself in the future, let's say 2030, 2040, looking back what 2015 delivered and how actually contributed to change the way we're doing things in a very positive and probably too optimistic way, but that's the way I approach that. So the question is that obviously there were 2015 is quite a crucial year because of the changing. So the light bulb is like what has made not just Europe, but in general, the whole society change towards a different way of functioning, a different way of dealing with the economy, in dealing with the climate, and dealing with injustice and poverty. And I guess one of the key things that probably has already happened is the question of how the SDGs, but also the whole community, and it's not Oxfam talking, it's basically the IMF and the World Bank talking about inequality. And extreme inequality, I think, has got into the real center of the debate. How are we going to advance on a number of social issues and education and health if we don't target extreme inequality? And I think this is already very much into the agenda. Now, are we happy with the somehow ambition that is in the NDGs in terms of tackling inequality? Well, not really. I think inequality is the gap, is the relative measure between the have and the have-nots. And we are the SDGs are really looking at the have-nots and not really looking at who are having the extreme wealth. And some projections say that in 2016, 1%, the top 1% of the population will have as much wealth as the rest of the world. That's not particularly equal. So definitely, unless we address that in the implementation of the SDGs, it's going to be quite difficult to implement that. I wanted to mention, if you allow me for 1 second, two more things about the implementation of the SDGs that affect very much how the European Union and the debate that's going to take place in terms of how we're going to implement that. Well, two things. First, this is not a technocratic fix. We need political will to change the way we do things. Political will means, are we ready to challenge the power? Are we ready to challenge those who are benefiting from climate emissions? Are we ready to to challenge those benefiting from this extreme wealth concentration? That's a question. And that's for governments, but also for active citizens, for us to hold into account governments in doing so. And then on the implementation, because there has been a lot of discussion about domestic resource mobilization, absolutely, all for that. But domestic resource mobilization is about mobilizing resources that exist. And what about the resources which are not given because they have been dodged? And there's an estimation by the IMF that about $100 billion a year are escaping developing developing countries' coffers because of corporate tax dodging and evasion. So we need to start tackling one of these issues to be able to have domestic resources.
Thank you very much. I'd like to now open the floor to comments and questions from all of you. Not all, but at least a good proportion. We've got about 45 minutes of discussion ahead of us. I would urge you to ask short questions so we can have an interactive conversation and also to identify yourselves. And if there's a question that you want to put to a specific member of the panel, I'd appreciate it if you do say so. So I'm happy to take a question kicking off now. Yes, please. Yes. Could I have a show of hands of other people? Thank you very much. Yes? Okay, please do start.
Thanks, and thanks for bringing us together on this lovely sunny day all of a sudden. So my name is Laura Sullivan. I'm the Regional Director for Europe and the Americas for ActionAid International, and also the Vice President of the Board of Concord. Quite a sentence there. I have two questions. I very much support what was said by Oxfam and by ECDPM, in particular around policy coherence for development, around inequality. Linking the dots and back to the issue of the EU Trust Fund, is there a way to use this EU Trust Fund to give a boost to the Commission's work around policy coherence for development and to really analyse the net impact of the European Union on countries where people are coming from, acknowledging the point that migration has existed a long time before these last weeks and months, and acknowledging that one of the root causes is conflict, but another is inequality, and another is climate change. So how can that be used to really look at how the EU is either reinforcing or undermining human rights and affecting vulnerabilities and driving people, and actually to take that message to the global level, because, of course, it's not just the EU. And then a second question related to domestic resource mobilisation. Really applaud the event in New York, but also the obvious commitment to this by the Commission. Within this, a risk, however, which is that we see us going down a road of a lot of focus on capacity development for authorities, which is excellent and needed. However, the much bigger issue is what was alluded to just now, which is actually challenging the power and stopping tax avoidance and making sure that the tax reforms we're going through now, proposing at EU level and hopefully at global level, are really looking at, number one, stopping tax avoidance and generating a lot more money, that could really be the way forward, question mark.
Thank you, Laura. Thank you for two very, very pertinent questions. I'm actually going to ask James, Natalia, and also the other panelists to respond to your first question about policy coherence in the trust fund that's being set up. Would you like to start, James?
Yes, thanks for that question. I mean, one of the really difficult things with PCD is actually with policy coherence is measuring and attributing and finding the right indicators. I think we all know that. I mean, at ECDPM, we continue to try and work on that and try and improve on it. But I would say that the availability of information to developing country governments about what the impact of policy is particularly important. I mean, if they can, if you can support local civil society organisations or academics to study these type of questions, then I think that is actually a big help from their angle rather than just from our angle. I mean, we have academics and civil society organisations that do a lot of good work on that in Europe, but there's a limited amount in. It's not non-existent, but there's a limited amount in developing countries. So I would say that is important. On the tax avoidance question, yes, I think there's a number of things that are required there. One is the global rules. I mean, we need to get to a level where there's global rules, and one of the arguments in Addis was precisely about who is the authority, where the global rules will be agreed. A lot of the running at the moment is done in the OECD, at the UN level. That is much slower, so there's no agreement on that, and that's one thing that civil society organizations have really protested about. So, first of all, setting up global rules is important. But I would say that capacity building is vital. I mean, when we were working on the European Resource and European Report on Development earlier this year, we looked at a number of case study countries where we found that investing in capacity in tax authorities locally had a huge impact on what the country can raise locally. I mean, so don't put it down. Capacity is vital, and I think you'll find that in many sectors.
Right. Talia, very briefly as well.
Yeah. Regarding the, just continuing on the question of tax matters, obviously there are, you know, international organizations for football, international organizations for trade, for many things, but not for tax, and it's definitely one issue which is really globalized. So definitely we're calling for an international intergovernmental body on tax rules with a level playing field for everyone to make these rules, meaning all countries taking decisions and being part of that. So that's a very concrete call.
Thank you, Klaus.
Well, a few short reactions. The trust fund is not for PCD purposes. We do a lot more on PCD in other areas. For example, you will see in about a couple of weeks' time a new trade strategy from DG Trade, and you will be surprised how many times you read in that sustainable, ethical, fair, and some other words. I was surprised, frankly. I was surprised. You will see there's a big shift announced for trade policy. The same is true already since some time in other areas. If you take private sector, if you have looked at our private sector communication of last year, we have laid down very clear criteria on when private sector engagement is good for development, and this should be should really be a guiding line for the future. So when we engage with private sector, we will obviously make sure that that what we have put in this communication is being respected. So we already do a lot on this. So I don't want to go into more detail. On the trust fund, the main objective of the trust fund is to put more resources in a targeted way into those countries which are those identified as being, for various reasons, the origin of refugees. And that means clearly the countries, some countries of the Sahel, and then also in the Horn of Africa. So we will just try to do more and more targeted activities addressing a broad range of questions. This will not be a guarantee that some people will still not come, but it can make a big difference. And we will get into difficult discussions. I would also like to not to hide that. We, for example, we have not been active in Eritrea anymore. And that is very much corresponding to the mainstream of development policy, which is to concentrate money on countries with good governance. And you all know how much this has been put forward. We are going to re-engage in Eritrea. Now, this will have to be at the price of completely forgetting questions like good governance, our and some of our Nordic member states have a problem with us engaging again in Eritrea because it really goes against the mainstream. But then we very well know that Eritrea is one of the key countries of origin currently for refugees. So we will have some difficult discussions in implementing the trust fund, implementing some of the other issues. That just as an example. Let me just say one more word on domestic resource mobilization. We are absolutely aware of what both Natalie and what you have said, because obviously there are much bigger flows than our development assistance. But if you read our paper on domestic resource mobilization, out of the 12 actions, 10 are things that the EU will do, not developing countries. We are not asking developing countries to tax poor people. We are certainly not. We are saying we are doing this and this and this and this to make it more easy for developing countries to collect taxes. We have our transparency directive here. We work with the OECD. We work on the transparency initiative. We are now working on conflict minerals, et cetera, et cetera. So basically our agenda on domestic resource mobilization is that we have to do our homework, especially in the field of corporate taxation, but also in other fields, raw materials exploitation, which then will allow developing countries to reap the benefit of their resources. And that's where capacity building comes in. That's obviously a condition sine qua non, which we also have to go through. But our agenda is really us helping developing countries to be able to collect more taxes and helping developing countries to spend their money in a better way. That's why our agenda is collect more and spend better. And if you read the paper, you will see exactly what that means. And I think that's precisely what we can do, but we are not asking the developing countries to do impossible things.
Thank you. I'm going to take a few more questions if Heike and Yves allow. Yes, please.
Thank you. Thank you for the very interesting debate. I'm Frédéric Vallier, the Secretary General of the Council of European Municipalities and Regions, European Section of United Cities and Local Governments, and coordinator of Platforma, the platform of local governments active in development. It's a question and a comment. One reason why we have the SDGs coming now, and we are very supportive, of course, of the initiative, is the result of the MDGs. The MDGs didn't reach all their targets, although some of the targets were reached, but not all of them, obviously. And so now we come up with a new agenda that is more holistic and probably better designed, we hope so. And one of the reasons why the MDGs did not reach that target, according to us, is that local governments were not fully involved in the MDGs. And we very much believe that if we want to reach many targets, we need to involve the local actors, local governments, regions, and put them, probably empower them to deliver and to build policies that will allow to reach all the targets, and not only the SDG 11, which we fought a lot to get in the list, addressing the local governments and settlements. But in fact, in many countries, there are no local governments. We were talking about Eritrea, for example. There is no such thing as local governance in those countries. So I would like to ask also how the European Union can support the empowerment of local governments worldwide and support the decentralization system. It's something that we, as European Section, we are very eager to do. It's not something that is understood everywhere in the rest of the world, but it's very important. And another question targeted to the crisis on refugees. Very short. It's an example of how much local governments are sometimes not seen as actors. The fund for supporting the asylum seekers of the European Union is open to member states and to international NGOs, but it's not open to local governments. And that's an example of how maybe we could also ourselves in Europe redesign some of our policies. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much indeed. I'll take a question from Dagmar. I see you, Jackie. I see you. Could you take the question? Yes, I see you too.
Thank you, Shada. My name is Dagmar Schumacher. I'm the director of UN Women here in Brussels. Thanks a lot for this very insightful panel. And you asked what we particularly liked. I particularly like the questions raised by Klaus Wodischhauser concerning the SDGs. And I would like to add one question, which is, what kind of monitoring and evaluation tool is the EU thinking of putting in place to really monitor implementation of the SDGs, both internally but also externally with the partner countries? And then would this also mean a different role for Eurostats? And then building on the discussion we had on policy coherence and the universality of the framework, how do you foresee bringing together different policy documents, for example, the new Gender Action Plan currently under formulation and then the Gender Equality Strategy? It's a great opportunity to put them possibly under some sort of an SDG chapeau. How can that happen? Thank you.
Right, thank you. I'm going to ask the panelists to answer these questions. Heike, would you like to answer the question also about local actors, local governments?
Yes, with pleasure. No, I think that's a point which is very important. And at the EIB, we already work a lot with municipalities within the European Union. And so I think, I mean, we have some in-house expertise on how to engage with municipalities. What we see now also outside the EU, if I take the example of Africa, for example, we try to develop new project concepts where we really implement this holistic approach, and we have a multi-stakeholder approach. So we engage with a number of partners and not only with the co-financiers, and then you have a borough on the other side, but really to engage
the various actors who are involved in any program we would develop. And this is, for example, very important if you look into areas of, if I may say, avoiding migration, so creating decent jobs in rural areas, for example, and so on. So you have to engage with smallholder farmer organizations and so on, not just with some local banks or microfinance institutions. And that's what we try to do by bringing in the right partners around the table. So I think...
But doesn't that make the whole process more complicated, more longer and more painful?
It's definitely more complex. I mean, we can't do miracles either. If you have more partners around the table with different objectives, you have to come to an agreement. And I would say the time to prepare projects takes a longer way. But I think it's worth the effort if we are serious, if we believe in these SDGs, and if we want to see results ultimately. It's that there is no other way of getting there.
Thank you. Eve.
Yes, thank you very much. Regarding municipalities, you know that this is a concept and an idea that AFD is very much supporting for a long time, for a while, and maybe you know that AFD is one of the only financial institutions in the world being in a position to provide direct loan, direct financing to municipalities without any state and government guarantee. And we have a long experience with regard to that, and this was very important in the discussion for SDG, and you know that there is a specific and dedicated SDG for sustainable urban development, and everybody knows the challenges we are facing with regard to urbanization, with regard to the growth of the cities in southern part of the world. And 60% of the population living in big cities within the 20 next years, this is huge. And this is very important to support directly municipalities and local government whenever it is possible, because you are right. A lot of countries does not have engaged within decentralization process and did not transfer power to local authorities. So there is a lot of progress to do with that regard. But also, apart from the SDG process, within the financing for development process and within the Addis Ababa conference preparation, local government has been put in front of the scene. And you can see that there is a dedicated paragraph within the Addis Ababa action agenda. This is paragraph number 34, I think, dealing directly to municipalities, encouraging development banks and financial institutions to provide direct financing to these municipalities, trying to support the principle of giving more direct access of financing through, for example, bond issuance from municipalities. And you have some recent experience, very interesting, in some municipalities in South, from Dakar, from in South Africa and other parts of the world, with local authorities being in a position to issue directly bonds and mobilize domestic resources to finance their investment, to finance basic access for the population to basic services delivered locally. So this is very important, and I fully share your view. Thank you.
Klaus, would you like to respond to Dagmar's questions, please?
Yes, I fully agree with Eve about the importance of local governments, and I've been saying that for the last 2 years, that the SDGs will not be implemented by national governments only. The SDGs will only happen if the whole society, and that obviously includes local governments. The question is how to do it, and just to give you one example, one of the main achievements, in my view, of our specific approach on budget support is to make sure that central governments actually hand the money on to local governments, because many local governments are empowered in the sense that they have obligations to do things, but they don't have the money to do it. And so to oblige central governments to pass the money through to the levels where the expenditure is taking place is extremely important. So certainly no doubt about that. On the monitoring and accountability, this is going to be complex, and not so much has been said about it. And Gaspar, sitting here, he's currently working on this. There are several things. First of all, we have to have this at national at country level. That's clear. We will have to have something at EU level. We have, as you may know, just introduced our results monitoring framework, and the results monitoring framework will have to be adapted to cover also things that are not currently captured. Eurostat will play a role in this. Eurostat will lead on negotiating the indicators. So they're clearly involved. And then there's the question, what will happen at global level? Because as you can easily imagine, I don't see any UN organization capable of doing this correctly. So personally, I would favor an approach where you actually share the work out. Just take an example. On energy, we have the Global Initiative Sustainable Energy for All. That would be an ideal framework to measure SDG 7 implementation. Then there is the Global Convention on Desertification. There is an SDG on that. So it could be obvious to use that frame. And then you go to sustainable cities, you have UN Habitat. So you could actually farm out a lot of the monitoring task to relevant and capable bodies. Now, this has not really been discussed in New York, and there's a certain degree of competition also in New York about who could be active. I would just put one more competitor into the arena, and that's the Global Partnership on Effective Development Cooperation, which has been created in Busan, and which has as a mandate to monitor progress on development and on how to make development cooperation more efficient. And development cooperation is the same as implementing SDGs. It's producing change. So the global Partnership for Effective Development Cooperation is also a competitor. And I think the stakes are still out on how this will actually play out over the next 2 or 3 years to come.
Dagmar also asked about the gender issue.
Ah, yes. Well, we have a couple of papers in our drawers, which we will bring out now to support. Once we have done the public consultation, because we first listen, but then we talk or we write, and then we will pull a couple of papers out of the drawers. The first one will be the gender action plan, because we will not wait there. for the moment, the only question left there is what kind of form it will take and when it will be launched formally. But maybe just one word about the gender action plan. If there is one SDG that could have priority over others, it could and should probably be that one, because that's actually a success factor for the implementation of many others. If we manage to do more on participation of women and girls in achieving all the development goals, it's that one. So that one should have a sort of a different role, maybe as number 17, which is a bit similar horizontal. Certainly our commissioner is very committed to make the gender issue a much higher priority than it was in the past.
Thank you. James, would you like to come in very quickly?
Yeah. Just quickly on the local government role. I mean, I think the debate has actually moved on. It's not so much a question of what can you do, but why hasn't it been done? I mean, it's now 16 years that the Cotonou Agreement already recognized the role of local authorities. So if that is not happening, why is it not happening? And I would hope that the local authorities would be putting that sort of case. I mean, looking at it myself, I think it will not help if we have too much direct funding from the European Commission right down to local authorities on the ground. I mean, that becomes unmanageable. There's no way you can do that across the board. Surely it must be, like Klaus is saying, to work through the national government. And looking at it, again, in the European Report on Development, looking specifically at this question, what we found was often the issue was the legal framework, that legal framework in particular countries did not allow local authorities to borrow money or under adequate terms or things like that. So the rules and regulations surrounding the way local authorities worked could be vastly improved. Again, this is typically, in development aid terms, an area where you can make a catalytic difference if you address what is basically a rules and regulations issue, a capacity issue. So I would suggest that the debate really has to become more sophisticated. What is the Commission going to do is actually not enough. What needs to be done at the local level in each case is really the issue for me.
Thank you. Natalia.
Just one question following on the discussion on the local authorities. I believe that there is a social contract between governments and citizens for, you know, society, and obviously local governments are part of that contract. The question is that, is the means to an end? Is the means to engage with active citizens? So I would say that the flow of aid and the trust funds, etc., should also go to support how citizens are active, how citizens hold into account their own governments, being local or national. And it's important to kind of close the circle of this contract and not just get into the local governments, which I think they play a very important role.
Thank you very much. I've got the gentleman here and Jackie at the back. Fabio, could you give the microphone here first?
Good afternoon. Thank you for the organization of this conference. I am Jean-Christophe Leger. I am in charge of the Ecosystem Fund of Danone, so I'm representing the private sector in a way. This is a fund of 100 million euro, an endowment fund, which is supporting today the co-creation of inclusive business model along the value chain of Danone. And I saw on the report that there are many things about engaging the private sectors into those development objectives. I have two questions, or I would like to have your perspective on two things. First of all, the way we do operate is to act small and think big. And we are facing a tremendous challenge, not in the co-creation process, but in the way we could get the co-funding on those initiatives for two reasons. First of all, the complexity of getting access to the different type of information, and as well the process of getting the funding from the different type of institution. And so how can we basically improve or facilitate the co-funding process? I'm thinking also as well about the European Bank. And the second thing is basically that we think a lot about large investment. And it's not only a question of large investment. We're talking about not so significant amount of money to launch pilot. So let's open also as well the discussion to program which starts small, about 1-2 million euro, and to scale those initiatives after that. Thank you for having your view on this type of approach.
Thank you very much indeed. I've got Jackie at the back. Jackie, can you put up your hand, please? No, not there, not there. Sorry, right at the back. I'll give you also the floor. Just in a minute. Yeah, right at the back. Yeah. No, right at the back, Fabio, the lady with the red scarf.
Note to self, small person shouldn't sit at the back. Sorry, Jackie Hale.
Big personality, Jackie, so don't worry.
Jackie Hale, Save the Children and co-chair of the Human Rights and Democracy Network. Quick comment and question. The comment, I just was aroused by Mr. Rudisharza's comment on Eritrea and just moved to plea to the EU not to take SDG 16 off the table in your discussions with the Eritrean government. There's a reason why Eritreans are fleeing Eritrea, and it's a failure of misgovernance. Misgovernance is the push factor, and I think that good money will flow to bad places and be wasted unless the governance issues are addressed, and those are the difficult questions. I'm just recalling Tunisia was the leading MDG light, and look what happened there. So let's put those governance issues back on the table. Coming to my question, it's about the siloing of development and humanitarian issues. Now, Goal 16 does bring something to the SDGs that we didn't see in the MDGs. However, we do not see that same, if you like, integration of issues relating to conflict-affected and fragile states across the SDGs. So we're in danger again of siloing these two discourses. Now, given that over half the 58 million children who are out of school are located in conflict-affected states, and given that the SDG summit has as its trope that we're going to leave no one behind, my question to Mr. Rudisharza, to the panel, and also to the EIB, is how will development actors now take on board the DRR and prevention aspects that really are their role, to give some space to the humanitarian system, which is really crumbling under the weight of what it's having to deal with at the moment. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Jackie. I have a question here, Fabio, and then the lady in yellow, and then I'll come to you, Max. If Christoph as well. Okay. Could I make a plea for brevity, please, your question especially, I think, please.
Alec de Sellier, I live in Nicaragua. And I noticed that the price of milk to farmers has dropped over the last years as big milk companies have moved into the country. So before we talk about development like that, we should also talk about decent prices for the producers of the raw materials in those countries. How are you going to tackle this point? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Could you put up your hand, please? Yes.
Thank you. I'm Emily van der Rens, working for WWF, and I have a brief comment following Mr. Rudi Schauser's intervention. I think a big novelty of those SDGs is that they are both universal but also indivisible. So it means that we are not going to do some cherry picking on which goals we want to focus on. It's just following Mr. Rudi Schauser's comments saying that we absolutely have to focus on the goal on gender and put more priority on that. I think they are all very important and integrated, and it's the achievement of all the goals we which will achieve a sustainable world. That's all.
Okay, thank you for that comment. Maximilian, and then Christophe, please. Clotilde, could you bring the...
Good afternoon. Massimiliano Paolucci, Special Representative of World Bank. I have a question that relates to the private sector, and I was very glad to hear your question. We talk about blending, and we keep on hearing about blending public resources with private. I was just wondering, I have three small questions. One, do we believe in blending, or is it just a way to say something because we know that ODA is going to go down? And talking as a person who represents an international organization, are we ready to work and flexible enough to then propitiate these partnerships between public sector and private sector? And last question is more related to, and is addressed to, actually, Natalia. Are we speaking the same language on blending? Do we mean the same thing?
Thank you. Christophe, please can you put up your hand so Clotilde can bring you the microphone.
Thank you very much, Christophe Yveteau. I'm the head of the UN Industrial Development Organization office in Brussels. I would like to come back to the roots of migrations, but also to the engine of development. We have talked of many aspects of those SDGs, but I think there's something that has been not been really tackled seriously, is what is going to be the engine that will create the wealth? How are you going also to reorient our system, economic system, towards sustainable development, more resource efficiency, energy efficiency, cleaner production? And I think that's the role of industry in development that is at stake. I think if you really want to avoid this migration, create opportunities, you will have to help, particularly in Africa. The gentleman said before about the milk. How do you ensure a good revenue? It's also by adding value to products. Most of African products are primary products that are exported. So there's a huge potential in transforming locally the products, and to do that, nobody will be able to do it alone. So you will need a lot of technical assistance, you will need a lot of investment by the EU, both in terms of ODA, of development banks, but also of private company going to Africa to support this process. So don't you think that this industrialization, which has been put as a priority also by the EU-Africa summit, should be one of those, I would say, a link that would help the other aspect of SDGs to really take shape? Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Christophe. I'm happy. One question at the back, and that will be the final question then. Clotilde, yeah.
Nico Kepitz from DEFCO. One of the reasons for the European Year for Development, or one of the goals, was to create more awareness about European citizens that development cooperation is having results, and that there is a win-win situation also for the EU citizens. This platform will also be necessary to achieve results for the SDG, to get support from the SDGs. How do the panelists think that this awareness can be increased among the EU citizens? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Excellent question also. So I'm going to go in reverse order, and this is possibly the last time I'll give you the floor. So it's your chance to answer these questions and raise any other issues that are burning in your heart and your mouth. So, Natalia, I'm going to ask you to come back. There was one question specifically for you, but let's move on different issues.
Well, on a number of issues, but I'll go straight to the question of blending. I'm not sure we're talking about the same thing, frankly speaking. But anyway, there has been a lot of discussion about blending and the role of the private sector in triggering that. The reality is that there is public spending for ODA, and I think it's proven that first, the investment of public funding for ODA, it has a very high rate of return, especially when you're talking about the poorest people, the poorest countries, the poorest, you know, those who are really lagging behind and they're not reachable. The question of blending and how you use part of this public funding to incentivize and to mobilize private sector investments, that was very much said and used as, okay, we don't have enough funding, so let's try to mobilize all the funding from private sector, which is very much needed. Now, the question is how, what is the rate of return that you're getting in this mix? And that's the key question, and I'm definitely not a banker, but definitely I think it's an important question to put forward. When and how is a good investment of public money to invest in this mix? That's the key question. And I think we all have this question, probably we have a different answer to that. But it's important to highlight that in just one figure, it's like ODA is still the highest or the most important foreign flow of 43 poorest countries. So at the end of the day, when you're talking about LDCs and the poorest people, you are talking about ODA, you're not talking about blending. So I wanted to answer that.
I just, I'm happy for you to answer any other issues that come up, and specifically the one by WWF on no cherry picking. I mean, among the SDGs.
Well, I think it's not so much about ideological approach about taking one or two because it's more interesting or not. It's like we are not going to be able to eradicate hunger or eradicate poverty if we don't tackle climate change. I think we know. And whatever progress has been achieved by the MDGs is being challenged by climate change, by conflict, etc. So I think it's not a matter of being ideological about it or what's your preference. It's about either you address inequalities, either you address gender inequalities, or you will not be able to sustain whatever poverty progress you are having. So it's a different approach. It's not just saying, oh, I like this one better, or I think I'll be able to deliver better on that. And I think it's important to stress, it's not an ideological approach, it's just being smart and understanding that it's a complex issue and it's a global. There are global issues that need a global response.
Thank you. Now everything is linked together in a way. In the 21st century, everything is linked together.
Exactly. Yeah. So since this is going to be my last opportunity to speak, I'd just would like to say a few more things.
Very briefly, Nathalia.
Very quickly. So we've gone through more than half of 2015. We still have the COP and we have the UNF CCC decision. I think that's quite an amazing moment for the EU to really deliver on many of the issues that we've been talking. So I really call on institutions and everyone else to push for that. And also saying that it's a global responsibility for the implementation of the SDGs. So the EU has been doing a number of things, but thinking forward, we all need an implementation plan. So I think it's important to highlight. Thanks.
Bringing in new donors into the package, I would say. James, please.
Thank you. Yes. On the question put by a colleague from SCF, that actually ties in quite nicely with the point, the other one from WWF about cherry picking. I mean, I think what we have to recognize here is that this is an integrated package, and it's an integrated package for the SDGs for a very good reason, which we've alluded to already, and we need to keep that on board. So if the Commission is indeed going to start work in Eritrea, I would say it has to keep the SDG 16 in the back of the mind. There's no way they can do without it. But that doesn't mean that you don't start with something else. And I think that will be the case all over the world, that in every country, in every situation, we will find that certain priorities are higher up, have to be tackled first, etc. And that will be true here in Europe as well. We learned that lesson with CMDGs, that certain countries moved faster and were able to make good progress in certain MDGs, others were more problematic. That didn't mean they weren't important. Precisely because they were problematic, it meant that they had to be tackled. But there were other things that, that could be done first, etc. So it's a question of, and in practical terms, we can't all tackle everything immediately at the same time. So I think in governments will be looking at it. We can tackle this bit fast, and that doesn't necessarily mean you forget the rest, and it mustn't mean you forget the rest. So I don't see it as cherry-picking. I see it as saying we have to prioritize, or we can prioritize here, we can make progress on this. And then I don't want to add to the discussion on blending, because I think Natalia got to the crux of the issue, but you said one other thing, and that was that ODA was going to go down. I think we have to talk that up. I mean, ODA is not going to go down. I think we have to all be saying it should be going up, and it still is needed. It may be a tiny proportion of overall development finance, but we do have to have that that goal that ODA has to increase. The EU has recommitted to it. Okay, I'm pushing the deadline back, et cetera, et cetera. But it is something that we do have to keep in the back of our minds, and we can't just let it slip into our parlance that ODA is inevitably going to go down. That's not acceptable.
Thank you. Thank you for that word of warning as well. Eve, a question that I really want you to tackle the others as well, if you like, is from our friend at Danone about the private sector, since you, IFDA, works quite closely with private companies.
Yes, IFDA, but not only. But the issue, this was the issue, more generally speaking, of social business development and raising within private sector. And I think that public financial institutions are trying to create some financial tools addressing these needs and trying to build some partnerships with private sector with regard to social business initiatives. And within AFD, we have recently created a set of tools in order to develop these kind of activities. And I'm sure that in other partner institutions as EIB and others, some similar tools are being created. I would like to come back to the issue of can we pick some SDGs? I would respond not, for sure not, because this agenda is now comprehensive. It should be reminded that SDGs are coming from intensive discussion involving everybody. It was an open working group. It was not only a discussion within experts. And it recognized the fact that development is comprehensive and is made from all the pillars. We are talking about social pillar, economic pillar, environmental pillar, and governance for sure. And obviously it is impossible to achieve the goal with regard to health if you do not address the issue of education, of agriculture, of economic growth, and so on. This is evident and this is obvious. So it is impossible to tackle because everything is interlinked. But you have some goals that are more cross-cutting. This was the case of gender, and I agree with Klaus that gender is very important because gender is regarding all the other SDGs. This is not one of particular, this is cross-cutting. And this is the same and maybe more important for the goal number 16, which is governance. And governance is the key. If you want to implement the 16 other goals, you need to improve governance. This is obvious. On blending, I'm sorry, but I cannot share your view that blending is created to replace ODA. This is not the case at all, because ODA, if you are looking at the figure, ODA has increased. It is not at the level of the ambition and the previous commitments. I agree with you. We are not at 0.7. But in absolute value, it has increased in the last years. And some countries have made very, very strong announcements. It is the case of UK, who reached 0.7. Germany announced some huge increase in budgetary resources allocated to ODA. So blending facilities, this is not that. And when we are talking about European blending facilities, this is not public-private. This is public-public. This is public grant money from European Commission and public loan money, concessional loan money, from European financial institutions as EIB and AFD. So this is public-public-public. And on domestic level, it is raising some private resources. from private sector and the banking sector. So this is not to replace ODS, this is to complement, to catalyze and to leverage and to meet the SDG ambition and SDG needs. And just lastly, to remind that 2015 is a very exciting year because we had this this discussion on financing for development. We are talking about SDG, and we are at the middle of the river because in December we will have the COP21 in Paris, and hopefully we will have a very comprehensive and very promising agenda for the 15 coming years. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Heike?
Yes, thank you. I would like to probably tell you a little story that we experience also, and which probably demonstrates how we are on the way of implementing these SDGs and why I think that we can. I mean, I wouldn't say go as far and subscribe fully to the rosy picture that you described in your article, although I would love to believe in it. But I think there are really ways of doing things differently. And I mean, we at EIB, we have had this experience, and we were endowed with a new envelope by the member states under the 11th EDF, which allowed us to implement and launch a so-called impact financing envelope. And if I take that example, I mean, we are working in the area of private sector in the ACP countries now for many, many years. But if I take that example of the impact financing envelope, which was launched last year, it really allowed us to do projects which we were not able to do before. Basically, because we were allowed to take a higher level of risk and looking for new ways, new instruments of doing things. And looking into that impact investment space, it's an enormously interesting space where you see a lot of things happening, new ideas coming up, and so it makes really something happening which didn't happen before. And the same is valid for blending. I see a lot of projects we have been able to materialize with other partners which would not have happened without blending. So I would say that it really allowed us to have projects with an enormous demonstration effect. And that is also our role. I mean, we cannot, as MDBs or as DFIs, finance everything. But by mobilizing and having pilot projects with private sector, or sometimes you need also to have a pilot project without the private sector yet, but which shows this thing may work. And so in the next time you replicate this way of doing things, you may then mobilize private sector to engage in that. And I think that is our role, and that is the new way of doing things differently. And we have had first encouraging results. We see a lot of interest from the private sector to engage with us. We were overwhelmed, for example, by the interest we had in a conference we have been organizing together with the Luxembourgish presidency, the EIB Africa Day in July, where we were totally oversubscribed by European and African companies to engage and discuss with us on how to foster investment in Africa. So I think there are a lot of opportunities out there, and we have to dare to go various steps ahead, and that will make things happen.
Thank you very much. Klaus, I'm giving you the final word. It really looks from all the questions we've had and comments that change is in the air. So we'll be watching you very carefully. What will we be getting in results?
Before answering to some of these questions, I think we owe a reply to the gentleman about milk. Now, I'm not a specialist in this field, but trying to say something intelligent, I have a lot of understanding with the farmers who produce milk. And but the problem is we have problems in Europe, different problems from Latin America. Here we have overproduction, and overproduction is never good for prices. But the basic problem, I think, and that would be the whatever approach you would want to choose, is that you have different power. Farmers mostly are individuals, and then they are up against big companies. And so the only way to get a reasonable agreement on farm prices would be for farmers to organize their selling power in a way that the big companies have buying power. So this is not let's say the way we do policy here, but just to try to add a word on these discussions, which are extremely difficult and complex. Now, on the other questions, Jackie raised the question of fragile states. You know very well that we are very committed to remain engaged in fragile states, and the fact that the SDGs don't cover this properly will not be a reason for us not to do so. And, for example, in education, I don't know whether you were there, but Commissioner Stylianides has just announced that ECHO will in the future spend a higher percentage of its funds on education in refugee camps, in fragile situations, etc. So this is clearly on the agenda, and we are committed anyways. On this question of are all SDGs equal, this is very clear. The SDGs are universal, but it's also clearly said that each country will have to define its own strategy on how to achieve them. So it's not so much a question of one SDG being more important than another. It's a question of what kind of resources and what kind of effort you direct towards each SDG. And as James said, that will have to depend on local situations. And the same is true for us as a donor. We have to look at where are we going to put our resources. But there's certainly not an approach to say we put an equal amount on every SDG. That will not work, and that's not going to happen. So it's much more a question of how can you achieve a maximum by doing what precisely and related to the SDGs. On blending, I have to say something. First of all, yes, we believe in blending. No, we are not ready to engage with the private sector. The problem is that, and there I have to actually ask Shada something, because she asked me whether I'm going to come for the 50th time to the Friends of Europe. If you organize another one on blending and private sector, I will come, because the fact is the following. With the exception of some of the development finance institutions like AFD, blending is not addressing the question of private sector, is not financing private sector at the moment, and that is a big gap. If I believe in blending, it's certainly because I believe that we have to expand the instrument to work also with the private sector, but we do not have the instruments currently. We need to find a way to partner with the private sector in an appropriate way, because you have to stay clear of questions like subsidies, of competition. So we have to find the proper instruments how to engage with development money with the private sector, and we are not there yet. That's definitely something where we have to catch up. Some of the bilateral donors have already made quite good inroads into this, but we haven't. And I think that the private sector is one partner that we still should try to bring much more to the table. I refer again to our communication, where we have put some very clear language on what are the conditions and the principles and the criteria that should be applied. And I really do recommend to look at that. So I'm looking forward to another seminar on this question. And I can only tell Christophe, yes, industrialization is something which other developing countries have achieved, but Africans have not. So we have to look at the question why Africa has not achieved it. And that is where there is a challenge, that's very clear. But it certainly will have to be part of an overall development strategy. So just to sum up, I think that there is still quite a big need to discuss what we discussed today. I really do hope that with the public consultation we get useful and interesting input. I'm sure about that. And then we will try to make the best out of it and propose a European strategy to implement the SDGs, which will also have to take into account what other international actors do, like the colleagues from UNDP and others, and the World Bank will be very important in this. And I suppose that will have to be reflected also in a new European consensus, because we are not alone on the planet. We are very important, but we're also not alone. So we have to have also our way of engaging with other important actors. And that's what I think what we intend to do.
Thank you very much, indeed, Klaus. I think this really is the start of your much-awaited public consultation, and I think it's been a very, very good start. I think we've got, I'm not going to sum up because you did it very well. It is a mixed picture. I have to say lots of hard work, lots of very hard work ahead, I think you'll all agree, implementing, monitoring, evaluating all these different SDGs is not going to be a piece of cake, not a walk in the park. And I think what one of you said on the panel very interestingly was the whole society needs to be engaged and involved. And that, I have to say, is something about the SDGs that actually excites me much more than the MDGs. What I like about it, and as the questions we talked about, is the integrated approach. I like that. I think it's about time the policy coherence dilemmas that we've fretted over here in the European Union for years, I think this is one way that we can settle those issues once and for all. I also want to come back to how I started, which was about the refugee crisis, the refugee flows, and I think that is a good get a starting point for a discussion on the SDGs and how they can actually help in their comprehensive way in tackling many issues to do with climate change, conflict, fragility, inequalities that Natalia mentioned in a more comprehensive and I would say perhaps sustained manner. So Klaus, we'll be looking forward to more conversations with you and your colleagues as we go ahead into this post-2015 era where I think a lot of new ideas, and I'm really hoping for new ideas after all these years of working on development policy, I want new ideas and I think we made a good start. Thank you very much to the panelists and thank you for your